This is the story of the Alka Indians. It began some years ago, and it has not been concluded yet. But here is missionary history in the making.
I'm Marge Saint, and as we walk ahead in the Christian life, it's good to stop occasionally and ponder God's guiding hand in it all. And so it is in the experience of all who have had a part in reaching the Alkas with the gospel.
Operation Alka actually began some 40 years ago by prayer. It became increasingly important for missionaries to know every available fact about the Alkas. They read the history of the region, which goes back to the early days of the Spanish conquest of Ecuador. Since the early 1500s, hatred spread throughout the Alka country, and this hatred was passed on from father to son. Then, beginning some years ago, the missionaries read the reports of the oil company and talked with anyone who ever had any contact with the Alkas. And they realized that the Alkas constituted a hazard to explorers, an embarrassment to the Republic of Ecuador, and a challenge to missionaries of the gospel. Ecuador is just a small country on the west coast of the great continent of South America. As our story begins, missionaries are living among every tribe in Ecuador, except the Alkas.
Makuma, Xiaomere is calling Makuma. Makuma, over.
The item that Frank wants to buy is diesel oil, 5 gallons.
About 8 hours away from the capital city of Quito, Ecuador, is Xiaomere. It was there that my husband, Nate, and I were stationed with Missionary Aviation Fellowship. There we had a jungle network by radio twice each day, and we could keep in touch with the missionaries such as Pete Fleming, the McCulleys, and Betty Elliott, whom you will be hearing in just a moment by the marvel of tape recording. It was just an ordinary day in September 1955 when we recorded these reports over the jungle network. And even then, five men, Roger Udarian, Pete Fleming, Ed McCulley, Jim Elliott, and Nate Saint, were working together. Five men with widely differing personalities had come to Ecuador from the United States, representing three different faith missions. And in September 1955, these men were drawn together, and the Lord began to weave five separate threads into a single glowing fabric for his own glory. As you listen, you will hear mention of the phrase, our neighbors. This is the way we used to refer to the Alkas during those days.
First of all, we hear Marge Saint talking with Pete Fleming.
Sandia, did you reach MD Quito for permission to take Doreen to the apartment? Over to Sandia.
Okay, if that's the best arrangement from there, it'll be perfectly okay,
Obie. And now we hear Marge Saint and Mary Lou McCulley talking on the radio network. By listening carefully, we can hear Nate Saint's voice in the background. He refers to the protective electric fence around the McCulley home at Arahuno.
Okay, Wauwatosa, I heard you calling Wauwatosa, so go ahead, Mary Lou, before I talk to Guayaquil, if you'd like. Go ahead, Wauwatosa, over. Okay, Mary Lou, I'd like to ask if you've heard about Doreen, and then we hear that there has been another killing among your neighbors downriver. Nate heard about it when he was out in Tena yesterday, and we presume that you had heard about it, but just thought we should ask. What they told Nate in Tena was that there were two men left with lances in them, that they weren't completely killed, but they were left with lances sticking in their bodies. That's all, Mary Lou, that's all. We'll be praying for you, you know that. And Nate says, keep the fence going, keep the fence going. Xiaomere is standing by for anyone on the network.
And next, we distinguish Jim Elliott's voice.
Go ahead, Shandia, with your traffic for Dos Rios. Over.
Hello, Betty. This is Jim. We'll be leaving here sometime afternoon and probably be in Dos Rios for supper tonight. Pete and I will be coming probably for supper tonight. Over to Dos Rios.
And so in September of 1955, God's impelling moved these five pioneering missionary families to crystallize their plans of months and years into common action. Here was their opportunity to carry the word of God to the Alcas.
I remember the night that Nate fed some yellow paper into his old typewriter and began writing. Last night, Ed McCulley, Jim Elliott, Johnny Keenan, and I were on the living room floor on elbows and knees, poring over a map of the eastern jungles of Ecuador. We had just decided that it was the Lord's time to try to contact the savage Alca tribe located somewhere east of Ed's Quechua Indian mission station at Arahuno. The actual search did not get underway until the morning of September the 19th, when Ed McCulley and I decided to go looking for his neighbors. More than 50 miles out from Ed's place, we caught sight of a blemish, barely discernible. The blemish grew into a well-defined pockmark and then into a good-sized clearing. This was it. It was an exciting old time. It seemed providential that we had investigated that tiny spot that turned into the first Alca clearing we had ever laid eyes on. We never did let down for a close look. In the first place, we had to watch fuel consumption. In the second, we didn't want anyone to get frightened on our first visit. We'd be back again with more thoughts on the best manner to approach these people.
About 2 weeks later, Nate Saint flew Pete Fleming with some others into an area where the Quechuas had never heard the gospel. They decided that since they would be flying over Alca territory, and since the two trips would mean that they would cross the area four times, they would keep their eyes open and fly slightly different routes each time. The first trip yielded nothing. But here is Mary Lou McCulley to tell about the second trip.
I well remember the men telling about this. They zigzagged slowly, favoring the more hospitable-looking jungle valleys. About 15 miles from Arahuno, that's where Ed and I lived, they spotted some clearings. Pete and Nate spoke only in English, but there was no hiding their excitement. Their Indian guide spotted the clearings also and immediately said, "Alcas." It was their first time up in the plain, yet they knew just where they were and could name the rivers. They flew down a little river and spotted a half dozen big houses with smaller ones around them. That was it. There they were, as plain as the nose on your face, and only 15 minutes from our place at Arahuno.
Everyone who was in on the plan was simply thrilled by the news. The most significant thing was that the men had located the first group of Alcas, and then in a couple of weeks had stumbled over the other group. It seemed to mean that this was the Lord's time to do something about the challenge. The men agreed to pray about the matter and compare notes further after the whole episode had a chance to sink in.
It was several days later when the men found themselves in our home in Chalmetta around that map on the living room floor. We just knew, all of us, that the Lord was leading us to do something about the Alcas. We tried to imagine how those people would respond to different approaches.
One of the problems the missionaries grappled with that night was that of language. But Jim Elliott came up with the answer by visiting Dayuma, an Alca girl who lived on a plantation only 4 hours' walk from Shandia. He found her cooperative and willing to teach him words in the Alca language. We want to tell you about Dayuma because she figures in the story as it progresses. Dayuma had escaped from her tribe of Alcas some 9 years before because of fear. She literally fled from the territory because of killings within her own family, and she was afraid for her own life. A presentation of gifts seemed the next obvious step. Perhaps a carefully planned, regular schedule of gift drops made over a period of time would show the Indians that the intentions of these white men were friendly, and the repetition would gradually convince them.
My husband, Nate, pioneered the spiraling line technique, which was used in the gift drops. Let me tell you what I know about it. He used about 1,500 feet of deep-sea fishing line wound on a reel in the plane. As they flew over the Alka houses, he slowed the plane to 55 miles an hour and held the gifts fastened to the line over the side of the plane. The door had been removed. And then they hooked up the automatic release mechanism made of my broom handle and three pieces of galvanized wire. Slowly, they lowered the gift packet until it well cleared the plane. The airspeed was allowed to come up to 65, and then began the job of reeling out the line with the gift. They continued circling in the plane until the gift was drifting in a small, lazy circle below. The ribbons were fluttering nicely. Finally, the gift seemed to be pretty close to the trees below. It was time for their first attempt. They rolled the turn steeper and held their breath while they lowered their prize to the earth. It wouldn't be ideal for it to hit the water, and it was heading close, close, closer, and plunk. It hit about 2 or 3 feet from the water, directly in line with the path to the house. The Alkas just couldn't miss it, since they probably got their water for cooking right at that spot. In a sense, they had delivered the first gospel message by sign language to a people who were a quarter of a mile away vertically, 50 miles horizontally, and continents and wide seas away psychologically.
Most of the 13 gift drops originated at our house in Arahuno. That is, they were assembled there, and I remember that first gift on October 6, 1955. It was an aluminum kettle with a lid. Inside, the fellows had put about 20 brightly colored buttons, obviously not for their non-existent clothes. Also, they included a little sack with a few pounds of rock salt. Knowing that the Alkas have no salt of their own, they thought if they would help them discover what the stuff was good for, it would help win friends. To these things, they attached some 15 brightly colored ribbon streamers about a yard long. They loaded in their emergency equipment, rigged their special gear, and took off for points east. Ed, my husband, was very keyed up about having his first look at the Alkas, and Nate was concerned lest some fall of his might cause him to miss on their first attempt. But as you have already heard, the first attempt was successful. On the second flight, Ed let out a yell and all but crawled out of the open door of the plane to get a better look. They were seeing their first Alka. He was running around, but not trying to hide. Pretty soon, there were three of them out in front of their big leaf-covered house.
The Alkas built a model aeroplane and placed it on the grass roof of the house. And each time the men flew over, they saw that the Indians had cleared more of the land around their houses, making it easier for the plane to come lower and lower. And thus, they could almost look full into the Alkas' faces. Jim Elliott said, "I saw a thing that thrilled me today. It seemed an old man waved with both his arms as if to signal us to come down." Think of it. Alkas waving to me to come. Oh, God, send me soon to the Alkas. And Ed McCully said, "If there were a ladder down from the plane to them, it would seem a good and safe thing to go among them." The team of missionaries now included Jim Elliott, Nate Saint, and Ed McCully. These three were definitely committed. Pete Fleming, who was as vitally interested, was not clear whether God's leading was for him to go or to stay. Then there was a real balance in the team, for some were impatient to get started, and others had a tendency to be conservative. Ed commented, "The whole project is moving faster than we had originally dared to hope for. And while I'm not for getting ahead of God, neither do I favor lagging behind." Another man was badly needed, and it was at this point that Nate thought of Roger Udarian. He and Raj had worked together on opening up other areas of Ecuador for the missionary cause, and Nate was sure of Roger's capabilities. He saw him as a soldier of Christ, a man capable of great effort, trained and disciplined. He was a disciplined paratrooper. He gave Uncle Sam his best during World War II, and now he was determined that the Lord Jesus Christ should not get less than his best. One day, Nate told Rog of Operation Alka and asked him to go along with them. Roger agreed immediately. But unknown to the others, he was at that time going through a deep personal spiritual struggle. And he began to wonder if he should join the others in the physical venture if he was not with them completely in spirit. But God, who causes us to triumph, brought him out of the spiritual difficulty. And Barbara, his wife, said afterward, he was cleansed through the Spirit for the task that lay ahead of him. And he went with a happy, expectant mind and his heart full of joy. On several of the last flights, the fellows spent time flying up and down the Kurarai River at a point about 3 minutes from the Alka houses, searching for a suitable sandbar where they might land the plane. On one such flight, they took along several paper packages of paint pigment powder in bright colors. These were used for measuring beach sites that might serve. They had found that when flying at 65 miles per hour, they could drop the little bags at 7-second intervals and quite consistently mark off 190 to 210 yards. Finally, they decided to use a beach which they measured from the air to be about 200 yards long. Twice they touched the plane's wheels to the surface and found it quite smooth. And they also noticed that if they overshot the landing, they would land in only shallow water. This would be their Palm Beach.
We wives were happy to help our husbands in the preparations, and there were many. Jim was to make the prefabricated treehouse in Shandia. A system of codes for radio communications was to be developed. Ed was responsible for making up the gifts for the Indians. Pete Fleming was to make up a 2-week supply of staple foods for the men in the treehouse in case the river should flood and cover the beach so the plane couldn't land. Roger Udarian had charge of the emergency gear and medicines. And then there was a model airplane to build, wind indicators to make, language materials, cameras and film to obtain, and it would be necessary to have long sheets of aluminum for the roof and walls of the little treehouse, as well as a bit of shelter from the sun on the beach. These could be fastened by a special arrangement under the plane and flown in that manner to avoid cutting them into small, less usable pieces. Raj was to draw up a plan of operation, and transportation and communication were to be taken care of by my husband, Nate.
This was not just a thrilling excursion. This was God's work, and the preparations needed to be carefully executed. They set the date for moving to the beach as Tuesday, January 3rd, 1956. The time had come. A time for soul searching, a time for counting the possible cost.
It was not the thrill of adventure that drew our husbands on. Their letters and journals made it abundantly clear that these men did not go out as some men go to shoot a lion or climb a mountain.
No, their compulsion was from a different source. Each of our husbands and each of us had made a personal transaction with God. His claim on our lives settled once and for all the question of allegiance. We were ready to obey him. The point of decision had been reached.
God's command, "Go ye into all the world and preach the gospel to every creature," was the motivating force which spurred them on. The question of personal safety was wholly irrelevant.
You should have seen our home in Artohono the last night as the men made a tentative schedule for the next day's landing on Palm Beach. The place began to look like a full-scale beachhead as each man checked and completed his equipment list. No detail was omitted.
Tuesday, a beautiful day. Everyone's spirits were high. As they made final preparation, so much seemed to hinge on the first landing and takeoff at Palm Beach. And because of the uncertain condition of the beach for landing, the pilot had decided he must take only one man with him on the first flight. That would mean a lonely vigil for someone. Raj was ruled out because he spoke only the Hivaro language. Ed had already beat Jim by pulling straws, but Jim held out, claiming to be the lighter of the two. When Nate said that a difference of 15 pounds would be decisive, they dragged out the bathroom scales. But Ed was only 7 pounds heavier than Jim, so it was decided that he, Ed, would be the first man to land on Palm Beach and await the arrival of the others. The five men enjoyed a peaceful breakfast in Artohono and a prayer time together. Then they sang one of their favorite hymns, We Rest on Thee. This melody and this hymn has become an identification of the entire Alka project, for its words so readily tell the attitudes and motives of our five missionary colleagues.
We rest on Thee, our shield and our defender.
Nate Saint, the pilot, and Ed McCulley were airborne in the little yellow family cruiser at 2 minutes after 8 on Tuesday morning, January 3rd, 1956, while Pete Fleming, Jim Elliott, and Roger Udarian looked on. The plane was soon out of sight, and then as it neared the beach, the fog thinned so they could safely slip down under and make an approach. They simulated a real landing, checked the full length of the sandbar for sticks and other hazards, and pulled up and around. This time, they descended between the trees in a steep side slip. The right wheel hit the sand within 6 feet of the water. As the weight of the plane settled on the wheels, the pilot felt it was soft sand. But it was too late to back out then. He hugged the control stick and waited. If they hit one more soft spot, they would no doubt nose over. But they never hit it. They jumped out rejoicing. The joy at being past that hurdle without damage momentarily made them forget the possibility that the pilot might not be able to take off again. It was great just to be actually walking and jumping on territory that belonged to Alka Land. They ran up and down the beach, removing sticks that could possibly puncture a tire, and then Nate taxied to the far end for a takeoff attempt. About 30 yards from the end, he felt the right wheel sink, and his heart sank with it. So he cut the engine, and Ed came running on the double. They lifted and pushed until, once again, they had the plane on harder sand, ready for a second attempt. As Nate took off, Ed stood at the opposite end of the beach with a movie camera. Nate later said it shook him a bit to think what Ed might record with that camera. Once again, the yellow plane was in the air, on its way back to Artohono for other passengers, and Ed McCulley was left alone on the ground. Jim and Raj went to the beach on flight number 2. If anything went wrong on this landing, at least there would be 4 of them there. The meeting there on the beach was jubilant. They immediately set about clearing debris from the beach, and then Nate made several more flights to bring the treehouse, tools, food supplies, while the fifth man, Peter Fleming, stayed at Artohono to join them the next day. By late afternoon, they had the house nailed into place about 35 feet off the ground. Two of the fellas flew over the Alca houses and called out in Alca phrases, "Come tomorrow to the Curaray." The second day, Wednesday, January 4th, 1956, Pete and Nate again flew over the Alca village, which they were now referring to as Terminal City. They saw fewer Alcas than usual in the clearing, which encouraged them to think that perhaps these Alcas were on their way to the beach. Back at the beach, Raj, Ed, and Jim were pacing up and down, holding out gifts and shouting welcome phrases to the trees. After landing, Nate checked the communication set and established contact with his wife back at Chalmetta. They also cut down a bothersome group of trees in the landing approach and built a little beach house on the sand.